Thank you, Bill, and thanks, Patrick, for your very interesting remarks. The concept of justice, as we are all aware, has had a very long and difficult intellectual history. The traditional notion of justice was based upon the assignment of rights and duties, rewards and punishments, in accordance with the rule of law. As Patrick pointed out, however, this traditional view has been significantly expanded in recent times to emphasize the elimination or reduction by the force of the state of economic and social inequality, a radical change in meaning. Now, let me start with Aristotle's classic treatment of justice, mostly in the Politics, to some extent in the Ethics. There are two types of justice for Aristotle. One is corrective justice, sometimes referred to as rectificatory justice. The other is distributive justice. Now, corrective justice deals with cases in which, for example, A wrongfully injures B, and B seeks for damages or for his compensation for his injuries. Or A fails to perform his contract with B, in which case B can go against A for damages. Distributive justice is a different animal altogether for Aristotle. Distributive justice deals with the distribution of honors, offices, monies, or any other things of value that are to be distributed among two or more people. Sometimes the rule of distribution is governed by agreement. In a business partnership, for example, if you want to know how to distribute the profits, you look at the agreement. In the absence of a controlling agreement, Aristotle begins with an assumption. If the persons who are to receive distributions are equal, the distribution should be equal. If they are unequal, they should get unequal shares. Equal for equals and unequal for unequals. Well, that doesn't take you very far, because the question is, on what basis are you to make the equal or unequal distribution? According to Aristotle, the distribution for where the recipients are unequal should be based on merit, But what's merit, and who decides? This has given rise to enormous difficulties over the centuries. Aristotle understands, of course, that people are not equal in terms of merit. Aristotle says that with respect to distribution among citizens, supporters of aristocracy identify merit with excellence. Supporters of oligarchy identify it with money, with wealth, or noble birth, and Democrats identify it with the status of freemen. One of the basic functions of government, of course, is to dispense justice. Aristotle argued that there are three true forms of government. That is, forms of government that serve the common interest rather than special interests. First, kingship or royalty, which is the rule of one. Aristocracy, in which a limited number of people rule. And what he calls constitutional government, sometimes translated as polity, in which the citizens at large administer the state for the common interest. Aristotle, of course, did not favor democracy, which he defined as government in the interest of the needy, which is a perversion of constitutional government. Aristotle gives an example that's quite relevant to our present concern. Quote, if the poor, for example, because they are more in number, divide among themselves the property of the rich, is this not unjust? If this is not unjust injustice, pray what is? Again, and this is still a quote from Aristotle, when the majority divide the property of the minority, is it not evidence that if this goes on, they will ruin the state? Aristotle, of course, also chastises tyrants and oligarchs who plunder the people. Subsequently, Aristotle repeats his point in rather blunt language. Quote, if justice is the will of the majority will unjustly confiscate the property of the wealthy minority. Sounds familiar. Aristotle explains clearly why there is a serious danger in what he calls the extreme type of democracy, which he calls the very worst form of government. Quote, "And in democracies of the more extreme type, there has arisen a false idea of freedom, which is contradictory to the true interests of the state. For two principles are characteristic of democracy, the government of the majority and freedom. Men think that what is just is equal, and that equality is the supremacy of the popular will, and that freedom means doing whatever a man likes. In such democracies, everyone lives as he pleases, or in the words of Euripides, according to his fancy. But this is all wrong, says Aristotle. Instead, men should live according to the rule of the Constitution, for it is their salvation." One of the problems with extreme democracy, according to Aristotle, is that it can lead to a perverted form of government in which not the law but the multitude have the supreme power and supersede the law by their own decrees. In this state of affairs, according to Aristotle, demagogues rise up to control the masses, leading to despotism. Quote, "The demagogues hold in their hands the votes of the people, who are all too ready to listen to them." At this point, the Constitution has been superseded, and constitutional government, that is, the rule of law, no longer exists. Now, this scenario laid out by Aristotle may begin to sound somewhat familiar to you. It is inconceivable that a philosopher who holds the views that I've just summarized could be in favor of the state taking away part of the wealth of some persons who have lawfully acquired it and redistributing it to others, simply because the former are wealthier than the latter. But this is exactly what the proponents of the fashionable concept of social justice today demand. As Barack Obama continually repeats, he's merely asking that the wealthiest Americans pay their fair share. But what is their fair share? Apparently, it's whatever the elected spokesman for the majority say it should be. This is precisely the position that Aristotle rejects. Now, let's take hypothetically the radical egalitarian criterion of extreme democratic theorists that every person engaged in the productive process to any extent should receive the same remuneration. Now, that solution is patently unjust because it treats unequals equally. People who are of course, different in terms of their ability, leadership qualities, willingness to work, endurance, and so forth, and their valid claims to compensation are therefore different. Moreover, the standard of equal incomes is counterproductive because it would discourage the best workers from using their best efforts, leading to lower productivity. The only practicable solution to this problem is to let compensation be decided by the spontaneous order of the free market, regulated by the neutral principles of the rule of law. This is what we call by the shorthand term capitalism. Now, I'm not going to go into the details of the intellectual history of the modern concept of social justice. Patrick has already discussed some of that, and it's discussed at greater length in his excellent book, The Concept of Justice, which I urge all of you to read. Meanwhile, let me just make a few brief points that'll put this discussion in the context of our present predicament. The topic of distributive or social justice was largely ignored by academic philosophers in this country and in England in the 20th century until John Rawls wrote his famous article, Justice as Fairness, in 1958, followed by several other articles and his influential book, A Theory of Justice, published in 1971. I'm not going to discuss Rawls's theory in detail, and I'm sure all of you are familiar, in general terms at least, with what Rawls was doing. Rawls argues that some members of the society, the founders, let's say, of the society, are favored with intellect, skill, energy, and other talents that are undeserved, but which give them an advantage over others who are not similarly endowed. Any success they gain, therefore, according to Rawls, is unfair. Now, if these people in the hypothetical original position of society would therefore agree, according to Rawls, that they should assume that everyone is ignorant of his own advantages, and that therefore we would agree to a rule of justice as fairness, under which some of these people who are talented and skillful and so on could gain from their inherent advantage, but only to the extent that the resulting distribution also favors the least favored members of society. What this formulation does as a practical matter is to justify the forcible redistribution of wealth for the benefit of the least favored, as defined by the political process. Rawls's theory, which was extremely influential, thus provided a theoretical justification for what the architects of the liberal welfare state were inclined to do anyway. You can hardly pick up a newspaper or a political magazine today without seeing many, many references to social justice. Of course, the term was used by the Occupy Wall Street people. I wandered out among those people, or they were right across the street from my office in Washington. I said, "What do you guys really want?" Most of them answered, "I want my student loans forgiven." Okay. The term is usually used to mean that the existing distribution of wealth is unjust because some people are wealthier than others. Of course, this has been true of most societies throughout the history of civilization, and is certainly true of free societies in which people can use their God-given energies and talents to improve the lives of themselves and their families. It goes without saying that I'm not defending wealth gained by fraud, deceit, theft, embezzlement, or other unlawful practices. I'm not defending Ponzi schemes, insider trading, stock manipulation, and so forth. There are already laws against that, which ought to be enforced, of course. What I'm saying is that if someone has acquired property or other or money or lawfully, whether by earning it or by receiving it as a lawful gift from someone else, the government is not for that reason alone justified in taxing him at a higher rate in order to benefit other persons chosen by the government. I realize this proposition is regarded today as radical, and it is. It's radically fair. Also, this does not preclude what we call a basic safety net to protect from penury those who cannot protect themselves, although, in my view, it ought to be administered locally rather than at the national level, but that's a whole other issue. But the contemporary welfare states go far beyond that. Many government programs provide benefits to those who are well able to take care of themselves. The point has been reached in many contemporary welfare states where the society simply cannot afford to pay for the level of benefits that the elective representatives have awarded, except through unsustainable borrowing. In several of the European states, as we can plainly see, the limits have already been reached and exceeded, and we're moving in that direction ourselves. The traditional precepts of justice, which I started out talking about, are summarized in Justinian's Digest, 6th century AD, as follows, quote, "These are the commandments of the law, to live honestly, not to harm others, and to give to each person his due." Pretty straightforward. From these precepts of natural justice, it follows that injuries are to be rectified, contracts fulfilled, stolen property restored, and quarrels adjudicated. And the traditional view of justice, as Patrick Burke points out in his book, quote, "an injustice cannot exist unless someone has done something wrong," close quote. Pretty good, Patrick. We can agree with that. In the modern notion of social justice, however, those who are targeted by punitive taxation have not done anything wrong. They just have more money than the legislators think they ought to have. As Michael Oakeshott has pointed out, the rule of law does not leave room for coercive redistribution of money or goods because such a distribution, quote, "requires a rule of distribution and a distributor in possession of what is to be distributed. But civil rulers in a democratic state have nothing to distribute because whatever they have to give away, they have to first take from the taxpayers. Frederick Bastiat makes the same point, as does Bertrand de Jouvenel in The Ethics of Redistribution. Am I saying that there's no such thing as social injustice? No, not really. If you take a look at Hitler's Germany, for example, that was an unjust society. And that's because its rulers deprived many Germans and others of life, liberty, and property without any lawful justification whatever. These actions were unjust under anyone's definition, and that's why the Allies were justified in punishing the worst offenders at Nuremberg. What concerns me is that the notion of an unjust society is now being extended to include societies in which the laws may be properly enforced, but there are wide disparities of wealth, which, as I noted previously, has been true of most human societies throughout history. A large proportion of the American public has been persuaded that people who are financially successful, who have followed the classic American path of gaining wealth to improve the lives of themselves and their families, are somehow evil, reprehensible, and unfair, and that they should be punished by subjecting them to increasingly severe levels of progressive taxation. This is an attitude that is punitive, mean-spirited, pernicious, and dangerous. It will divide our society and make it less productive. Okay, we've seen that the intellectual foundation for the contemporary theory of social justice is very weak. In the public mind, social justice seems to mean little more than an emotional feeling of collective compassion for the poor. Compassion is a perfectly valid and worthy sentiment. The problem is that when politicians talk about compassion, they're talking about compassion with other people's money under penalty of fines and prison sentences. Whatever that is, it is not compassion and it is not charity. It is what Bastiat called bogus philanthropy, where some try to live at the expense of others. Just please don't call it justice. Thank you.